Thank you. Well, good afternoon. I am Diane Herriot and I'm a parliamentary librarian, and it's my pleasure to welcome you to this afternoon's parliamentary library lecture on the subject of reform of copyright law. Copyright is, of course, an issue particularly dear to the heart of all parliamentary librarians. But copyright is an issue that inspires robust debate and interest more broadly in the community. The ALRC is, of course, in the early stages of an inquiry into current and future desirable uses of copyright material in the digital economy, with its final report due to be delivered by 30th November 2013. Given the breadth of views and perspectives on this matter, we anticipate hosting some further lectures on this topic in the autumn sittings, including the Commissioner in charge of the review at the ALRC, Jill McKeough. Today we're fortunate to be able to welcome Dr. Nicholas Gruen, who I think is a repeat visitor to the library for a lecture series. Is our only room. Dr. Gruen, I could say, of course, needs no introduction, but I won't. He's a prominent Australian economist and commentator on Web 2.0 and is the founder of Lateral Economics and Peach Financial. He has a long list of career achievements, including work as an advisor to government, appointments to the Productivity Commission, and as director of the Business Council of Australia's New Directions Economic Reform Project. More recently, he chaired the federal government's 2.0 task force in 2009 and is a strong public advocate for economic reform, innovation and open government. Dr. Gruen will speak for around 30 minutes today, after which he's kindly agreed to take questions. Thank you.
Okay, thanks Diane. So that's an outline of what I want to talk to you about. And so without further ado, I will move on to what I want to talk to you about. So that is a property right, and it's a property right that we most understand and understand from our everyday lives, real property. And one of the things that bedevils intellectual property debate is an idea of the idea that defining the perimeters of a piece of property is somehow threatening the property. In fact, it defines the property. So here we have the owner of the property owns this property, and the fences tell you the boundary between what the owner owns and what the owner doesn't own. But that's just the beginning of it, because there are airspace rights above it, and I'll tell you a little bit more about those a bit later on, and there are mineral rights below that are not owned by the landowner, even though the landowner does have some residual rights as far as mineral rights are concerned. There are all sorts of requirements on the landowner to maintain the land in particular ways. There's an easement, which means that there is multiple use of this property and other people are continuing to use it while somebody owns it. And then there are the whole bunch of other rights that other people have, which can turn out to have quite a substantial impact on the owner of those of that bit of real property. So I begin the presentation with an explanation like that because the word exceptions to copyright has a kind of a negative connotation. It's as if we're taking rights away from someone. Exceptions to copyright are best thought of as the things which define the rights holder's right. And those, and this is something that the Attorney General's Department put pretty well in a discussion paper in 2005 when the issues that I'm going to talk to you about now were last addressed in a fairly comprehensive way. So exceptions define IP rights and they answer questions like, how much can I quote without permission? So, in fact, I've licensed this paper that I'm talking to you about Creative Commons, but if I'd licensed it copyright, all rights reserved, you would still be able to write a newspaper article about it and you would be able to call it Accepting the Future without breaching my copyright, because that's an exception to copyright. And that, so my copyright doesn't extend to each of the words or a phrase or anything like that. And then the question becomes, well, how far can someone quote from the report? And that's another important kind of question. Another issue that has come up very much since we started recording things, which is an awfully long time ago now, is can I change, can I take my CD and turn it into MP3 files? Can I time shift? And in 2005, lots of parliamentarians were a little taken aback to find that they and their families had been breaking the law for decades as they taped the footy and then watched it when they got home. And so they made a law to say that it wasn't breaking the law to do what everybody was doing and they were doing as well. And the internet is a very complicated place. And as you will see, it now turns out that the way copyright is being applied requires an internet intermediary whose only business is distributing work for people who legitimately produce and seek to gain from content, to deliver that content. And now we need to think about their situation because of a change in the way in which copyright works in the digital world compared with the analog world. So one of the things that we were asked to do is that when copyright is reviewed, one of the standard things that happens is that the copyright industry, particularly the content creation industry, goes and gets a measurement of how big it is as a share of the economy, and it's an important part of the economy, and the argument is, therefore, it's important to retain strong copyright, which isn't something we disagree with. But firstly, these industries themselves depend on exceptions to copyright. It's important if you're producing a newspaper or a book or a magazine, you might want to comment on this paper that we've written or a speech that someone's given, and so you need the ability to quote it, and therefore you're using an exception to copyright. But there are a large number of other industries which actually also are involved in the creation of content and the creation of copyright often. And they depend on exceptions to copyright as well. And I've given you some examples of those industries there. When you look at both of these industries together and say that these are all industries that depend on limitations and exceptions to copyright, as they also depend on, many of them depend on strong copyright, you find that this part of the circle, other than that part of the circle, is bigger than that circle. So in terms of value added, this is 6.5% of GDP. That's a pretty rough measure because if you look at the comparison with other countries, it so moves around so much that it's telling you that this stuff isn't being done terribly well. I don't mean by that that PwC could have done a better job. It's just that, the same goes for us. We're working with statistics that are difficult to compare country with country and so on. And so if you look in terms of value added, content industries add $93 billion to our economy and employ 900,000 people. And taking the exceptions industries and the content industries together, that's more than double the size of the content industries alone, and it's a larger share again if we're looking at employment. So that's kind of important to know, and something else that's important to know is that copyright industries, or they're called copyright industries in the PwC work, the PricewaterhouseCoopers work, we're calling them content industries in that diagram. Over the last 5 years, they've actually gone backwards. They've actually shrunk on average each year. And the exceptions industries, or the total picture, has grown. And the best comparison between the two sectors is this orange bar here with negative growth, and education, which comprises more than 50% of the exceptions industries. In terms of dynamism, in terms of contribution to growth, this disparity between the content industries and the exceptions industries is growing, because the exceptions industries are growing faster than the rest of the economy, in fact quite a bit faster than the rest of the economy, and the copyright industries are slowly shrinking, or at least have done over the last 5 years. I suspect that's not, I suspect the normal state of affairs is that they would grow, but they probably will shrink as a share of GDP. The other thing that's worth having a look at is trade performance, because that tells us something about how competitive these industries are. This is copyright. This is the copyright industries, and as you can see, we're sitting at $30 billion, or about 2% of GDP, in imports every year. And if there is a trend, it's probably a little up, although since here it's been pretty static. But it's certainly been up since a long time ago. But you can say that that's pretty static. And as far as exports are concerned, this is a much smaller number. This is $8 billion here, and we're currently sitting at $7 billion or thereabouts, and so that's 0.25% of GDP. So the disparity here is very considerable, about 4-1. If we look at exceptions industries, we find the exact converse of that. We find exports growing strongly and strongly in excess of imports. Not that many industries where that's the case. I suppose it's true for mining and agriculture. So that's also something to be kept in mind. Okay, so let's talk about copyright. Copyright comes to us from the Statute of Queen Anne, in 1710. And it was a pretty simple idea. In development economics, one of the things you've got to think about, and this is development economics, is economics in England in 1710, one of the things you've got to think about is the simplicity of administration. It's actually one of the reasons why tariffs make some sense, or arguably maybe an efficient way to raise revenue when countries are doing very badly, because when they're very poor, because it offers a way of collecting revenue. Anyway, that's an aside. The point about copyright is that it locks onto the act of copying. That is what triggers the copyright. The owner of the right has a right to give their permission or to withhold their permission from anyone who copies a work. So it only applies above the line. It's only of any significance above the line where copies are made. No copies are made there. And so the domain of analogue copyright, the number of businesses and people who have to worry about it, are here. Really kind of one person in a way, the printer and anybody who might want to start printing copies. So that's where the copyright focuses. These people who buy goods from, or who hold goods that have been printed, these people who drive them around, off they go, don't have to worry about any of this stuff. It's got nothing to do with them, because they're not making copies, so they can do whatever they like. They've got a legitimate copy and they can take it anywhere they like. None of that is true in the digital world. Firstly, the digital world is massively more complicated. We don't just have creator, publisher, printer, and then some distributors and consumers. This is a much simplified diagram. Microsoft wouldn't help me out making it more complicated without spending hours of my time, so I didn't go ahead with it. So we've got search engines to help people find things. We've got ISPs, we've got telcos, we've got infrastructure providers of all sorts of different kinds. Every one of them makes a copy every time they do anything with any of this content. Every router makes a copy of everything that goes along the wire or in the Wi-Fi or whatever on its way to the viewer. I don't know how many copies of this report my Android phone has. It's certainly got one in its memory. It's had lots on its screen, and there are probably scores of copies of that in there. And yet, the trigger for copyright law is the making of a copy. And copies are being made all the time and then destroyed all the time, in their millions, in their billions. And so we're looking at a case here of legal obsolescence. And something quite similar to this happened when these guys were, well, just after these guys proved that we could actually get into the sky and fly around, even though that everything that was in the sky was heavier than air. Because at the time, in the United States, the legal doctrine was, from the ancient Roman, whomever owns the soil, it is theirs up to heaven and down to hell. And you can see that would be a bit of a problem for getting around. That's the kind of problem, although it's much simplified, as you can see. That's just a few property rights to negotiate. And that state of affairs was in effect in the United States from 1903, December I think, maybe November, when the Wright brothers flew, until 1942, when a chicken farmer in the Midwest got pretty upset that the US military planes were upsetting his chickens. And he took them to court, and a new regime had to be worked out. And maybe a new regime has to be worked out in copyright, we don't know, nobody knows what that looks like. But we have a major problem, a very similar problem, of legal obsolescence here. And I'll take you through some of that. So our approach in Australia has been what's called fair dealing. And that involves saying it's illegal or certainly an infringement to copy unless you can bring yourself under one of these fair dealing exceptions. The major in principle problem with that is that parliamentarians might not have thought about the particular way you want to use digital, the particular innovation at any stage. So there's a huge delay. But even then, the exceptions are invariably technology specific, and so immediately things change and they come up for further review. Sometimes they're technology specific in ways that the parliamentarians don't even know. They're sort of trying to be technology neutral, and they don't even know how technology specific they're being when they make those amendments. So here are some. The other thing I was just before I go on to that, we did a back of the envelope calculation, which in a sense is very similar to the sort of thing you could have done with the airspace law and civil aviation. What would the costs be of actually negotiating your way through all the chicken farms and the corn farms of the Midwest in trying to fly from New York to LA in the first part of the 20th century? What would it cost? Because what's happening is that people are muddling through just as they did in US aviation. They're saying, well, we're not going to, you know, Google doesn't write to everyone and get their permission to put them up on a search engine or any of the many things that they do, because they know that people mostly want to be on the search engine. But there are some people who don't, and so that's a problem for them. That's an uncertainty for them. So what would it cost to do this by the book, by the kind of process that is somehow envisaged in the legal regime that we have? And it would cost probably more than half the Australian economy to do this with just Australian websites, and several times the Australian economy if we were actually going to try and do this for the internet as a whole, to have the internet here with everybody serving up the internet knowing that they had copyright permission. So I don't think we didn't recommend that we go down that path. So let's have a look at fair dealing and flexible exceptions. So the problem here is that that it's illegal to copy except if you come within an exception. Here's some of the exceptions. Time shifting was illegal until 2006. Audio is so long as you don't have digital rights management in the audio, can be format shifted, otherwise it's illegal, but not if it's downloaded. So you can format shift it from, say, CDs to an MP3, but not from an MP3 to some other format. I hope this isn't making any of you people nervous out there. Videotape can be format shifted, but not other forms of video like files. Print, that is the things that the parliamentarians and the regulators were thinking about when they wrote the section. They can be reformatted as digital, but if it's not a book or a magazine or a periodical, it can't be. So you could have some nice legal arguments about that, I guess. But a digital original can't be reformatted. So if it comes in a digital form, that's it. You can't change the format. This is a nice one, which is that a library can copy your work if it's been stolen. It's just a tricky logistical exercise. Although, giving the legislators the benefit of the doubt, I guess they hope that they'll go to another library. And if they do go to another library, we've got some more news for them. This is section 49 of the provisions that allow libraries to make copies for users, and that's just about 3/5 of it, because it goes on to there. And you're going to need, so a library's going to need to get a lot of legal advice about how to do this, and the legal advice will produce a manual. And the manual will probably have quite a few dumbed down steps in it, because the section will probably allow people to use discretions which somehow disappear in the manual, because otherwise the manual would be just as confusing as the legislation. And it's not really a very sensible way to proceed. For example, section 49.7AD requires libraries to destroy any copy, any file that they've made, which was made in the scanning in of a document which they are getting for a user. So when the next person, if somebody else comes along and wants the same document, it's got to be scanned back in. It's not so difficult in this building. Do what you like. That's a way that we keep these problems from the people who make the laws. It's not a problem in this building. This is roughly the sort of law that applies in the United States, and I'll not just in parliamentary libraries, in congressional libraries, but I'll go on to that in a minute. That's interlibrary loans, because the other one was just users getting copies to users. And the alternative is flexible exceptions. Now, in the United States, which is, I'm only using as an example of a flexible exception, I'm not saying we necessarily should use that, the test they use, but we need to do something like that. They have a number of fair dealing exceptions, and if you can bring yourself within those, well and good. And then they have a general test. And the general test is based on self-assessment, subject to legal review. That's how we run our tax system. That's what negligence law looks like. Would a reasonable man do this or that in the particular circumstances? And, of course, that isn't anything goes or anything people think, because that's all justiciable. That can all be taken to court and litigated. And the test of fair use comes to us from common law, but it's been codified in the United States. And it's the sort of thing you expect to find in common law, which is that it sort of reads like negligence or something. It's couched in this, well, you work it out for yourself. And the four tests are, you look at the purpose and character of use, including whether it's commercial or non-profit educational purposes. You can work out from your own common sense which way getting into each of those categories would swing the balance in favour of or against liberality in interpretation. The nature of the copyrighted work, the extent of the portion used in relation to the whole work, and the most important test from an economic point of view, which is whether this is undermining the market in the work. And that test has worked very effectively in the United States and has underwritten substantial innovation in their digital economy. I'll get on to some of the examples of that in a minute, but how to invest... then we had the job of trying to value the difference between these two regimes, and that's no easy business, and I don't want to tell you that our numbers are some extremely accurate reflection of that. What we tried to do was to look at what evidence, what microeconomic evidence there was, and then come up with something which could... which was surely a conservative estimate. And so booze studies in the US and Europe are studies of investors, and they ask questions of investors. The particular questions they were looking at are questions like, if you're investing in providing internet services, how concerned are you that you might, that if the law changed, you might be required to exercise due diligence with regard to your handling of illegal or not legitimate copyright content. And the results were pretty stark as far as inadvertent copyright infringement, making it easier to hold websites liable for others' uploads of unlicensed content, reduced the pool of investors by 81% in the US and 68% in Europe. That they reported that they would require a huge increase in rates of return. Now, I would say that the degree to which they said they needed that increase is probably implausible. It was so high. But that's what they said. The result is that if you try and Australianize, if you try and, you try and apply that to the Australian situation, you come up with the figure of about $2 billion of risk that is being borne in this sector in Australia each year. That we don't convert that into a welfare number. We don't say the Australian economy is $2 billion worse off because of this, because I think what's going on is what was going on in America. Basically, most of this risk that people are doing what their competitors are doing, and they're kind of writing it off and saying, look, I'm sure this will get worked out if this thing goes off the rails legally. But that's the number that we got. The other issue is... The other issue is what effect this has on productivity. The internet is an enabling technology. It's like the internal combustion engine, steam engine, electricity, the running water. It's something which you can't isolate its effect on one sector. It's a general platform on which productivity growth occurs. And it has a major, IP uncertainty has a major impact on early stage investment, and early stage investment is a major contributor to innovation. And again, we didn't factor that directly into our modelling. To try and get a handle on the significance of investment in the internet, we were asked to generate numbers for the value of search, the value of social networks, the value of caching. But if you take an example like search, you can value it in a whole bunch of different ways. I think most of the people in this room would appreciate that if there was no search, that would very seriously degrade the value of the internet, if you can't find the stuff that is on there. And it's exactly the same with caching. You can think of caching, which is internet infrastructure, which means that the second time you download a particular file, you don't have to download it from California, you download it maybe from the ISP that's nearby, or maybe your own phone has cached the copy, or whatever. That kind of caching is basically central to the efficiency of the internet. It isn't a matter of the difference between half a second and a tenth of a second. It's the difference between a technology stack that can actually work and a technology stack which gets caught somewhere because some function couldn't be done because it wasn't available. So the value of caching is a small number at the minimum, and might be 0.5% of the value. Sorry, and might be 50% of the value of the internet at its maximum point. It's a critical ingredient. Akamai, or Akamai Technologies, is a company that was started out of MIT. It's a piece of MIT software, a piece of MIT technology, which was an obvious thing for a company to start up providing. It's been worth as much as $60 billion of Carmine Technology. It's now worth $7 billion. It is why, if you go onto the internet in Australia and you look at Amazon or any number of other websites, they load up incredibly quickly. It's sitting there in the background doing all sorts of things that are much cleverer than I could explain to you or even know myself to do all this sort of stuff, and it's not just caching, it's a whole bunch of things. This is what they say in their annual report, and I'll let you read that. I presume you can all read that to the back. And I'll have a drink of water. And Apple has a similar disclaimer on its annual report, and there are lots of these things around. So this is a serious business. I'll skip over that slide. So looking at this, we decided that we would try and run an experiment and say, imagine that the difference between these two regimes one generates productivity growth more than another. One will generate faster productivity growth by 1/100th of the real rate of growth of that sector over the last few years. And then we apply that to the limitations and exceptions sector, which is the sector that depends on these exceptions, which is education and content and all these sorts of things. What would that do? And the answer is that it starts at a small number and it builds up over time, and by 10 years it has got to nearly $600 million per year. So finally, consider the most valuable company in the world. When Steve Jobs got back to Apple, this is what he put out. It's awfully dated now. But he had an idea, and the idea was realised over the rest of his lifetime at Apple. And the idea was that he could reinvent the way in which he could play a part in digital convergence by reinventing the way people related to content, basically. And how many people remember what the slogan was for that product? And it presages the iPod. And I haven't reproduced the ad here, of course, because then I would have had to get permission to reproduce it, even though I know Apple would be quite happy for me to reproduce it. These are the kinds of bits of sand in the wheels. Steve Jobs wasn't advocating that people... That doesn't mean rip stuff off in the Australian vernacular. In fact, I don't even know if that exists in America. He was talking about the iMac and the iPod changing your relationship with the content that you have legitimately bought, your CD collection. You can take your whole CD collection and it can all be on there, and it can all be on your iPod, and you walk around with it. And that was illegal in Australia. And it didn't come under any of the American fair dealing exceptions, but there was a permission to innovate. He was taking a risk because he didn't know how the court case would end up. But the permission to innovate was the doctrine of fair use. And the court case came up, and the court held that Steve Jobs was not damaging the market of the CD owners, and they said that's fair use. And the richest company in the world is built on that fair use, on something that was illegal in Australia until 2006, and which we made legal because we could see everyone was doing it anyway, which is a pretty precarious basis on which to invite innovation into our economy. So then, finally, These are some businesses that depend on fair use in the United States. I don't want to tell you that if we had fair use, they would suddenly pop up in Australia. I don't want to tell you that it's the only reason they exist in the United States. It isn't. It's probably not one of the top three reasons they exist in the United States, but it is a non-trivial reason. And as I think Eric Schmidt answered to David Cameron when David Cameron said, what would it take for the UK to host a Google, to have the next Google? Eric Schmidt said, well, you know, maybe the first thing you could do would be to have a copyright regime that wouldn't make what we do possibly illegal. So these companies are worth the best part of $800 billion, and they're built on, and one of the bits of legal infrastructure that gives them security in the economy is the US doctrine of fair use, the idea of a flexible exception, a permission to innovate in addition to the carved out exceptions for fair dealing. And if you add these other companies, you will find that that amounts to well over $1 trillion of value. So that's why this is not just a nice, neat little no-brainer in an economic sense, as a microeconomic exercise. That's why, in addition to being common sense, it really matters in terms of the economic significance of it. I'll leave it there and very happy to take questions or comments or discussion. Thank you.
I should actually note that even for the Parliamentary Library, copyright's not quite that simple to deal with realm.
So, okay, but at least you probably can. You're pleased to have Section 48A.
We're delighted to have Section 48A.
A lot of few other libraries would like to have it too.
No, we're very grateful for Section 48A. Any questions, or are you all a little stunned by the video?
So let me ask a context question, because I don't know a lot about this stuff.
Sorry, would you be prepared to identify yourself?
No.
Okay.
Can you tell me, are we in the process of considering how to change these?
Yeah, sorry, this is in the context of an Australian Law Reform Commission inquiry that's just started, an issues paper's gone out, on exceptions to copyright. So it's coming up in its own good time. It's an 18-month inquiry, but it's coming up.
And the one of the big issues is whether we move to a US style.
Indeed. Flexible, whether we have flexible exceptions or whether we go on with this business of saying there we'll have that exception, and can we get everyone in the room to agree on that exception? Okay, well, we'll carve this bit out because somebody's upset about that. You want an exception? Who wants an exception? We go right through it. This is how we had a local content scheme in cars and all of this kind of policy, just getting people in no longer smoke-filled rooms, but nevertheless in rooms to make ad hoc deals. In which we say, well, you can time shift videotape, but you can't time shift anything else.
Fair use is obviously used in America.
Yeah.
Globally, who else has those sort of flexible exceptions compared to like Australia?
Okay. The Singapore has basically copied America as part of its digital strategy. Mm-hmm. Singapore is trying to attract data centres. Google has recently made a decision about where to locate its next data centre. I don't know how seriously Australia was in the running, but we like to think that we were in the running. And guess where it's being located? Singapore. Canada has fair dealing exceptions, but has infused them with a great deal more flexibility than ours. Those are the examples that I can give you, and the lawyers, the IP lawyers, could probably give you a few more. I wouldn't be surprised if this is sort of a bit like tax competition, or it'll be something that gradually gets done. I don't know whether it'll be universally done, but the smart money is on fair use and not fair dealing.
your thought on innovators, researchers, academics who are quite prepared to share and share across borders, lots of information, people doing, you know, data mining,
yeah,
all this great innovation coming, and commercial managers sitting over them saying, don't share that because we might be able to make some money and we're going to lock this all up and protect it because we want to make money out of it. When in reality, they might make $5 million, but if they share it, they could end up being 10% of $5 billion.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, it's a huge topic, and you've heard me talk about it more, you know, in another context, which, I mean, the example of this is Google, Facebook both made the decision that each of those are public goods, Google and Facebook, anyone can use them, and they could have, but they didn't have to be public goods, they could have, you know, you could not be able to use Google unless you logged in, and likewise Facebook, but they realised they could make more money with it as a free good than as a paid for good, and a remarkable state of affairs. Unfortunately, there's still the case, there are going to be lots of cases where businesses can, and I'll give you an example. Kookaburra sits on the old gum tree and made some money for someone. Did they know they were going to make money? No. If you went and said to them, look, here's your back catalogue from 50 years ago, why don't you let people use it? You can be guaranteed that that would create some public value, perhaps quite a bit of public value. Creates almost no public value in private hands, but every now and again somebody picks up a windfall. So why are you going to give it away? One of the most, this is a really telling diagram, which is somewhat off topic, so it's not part of my presentation, but it's a really fascinating diagram because we tend to think that sort of the models in economists' head is that self-interest is, you know, that self-interest gets a lot of things done. Here are here's the amount of publication by date of books and other items on Amazon. If the copyright holders in this part of the graph, they have something to gain from selling copies. So if the copyright holders were acting in their own interests and this was a friction-free environment, you wouldn't see this big U-shape. It would look like that. And with these people taking progressively less because they're forced to take, you know, this is a 10-year-old novel and you can't get as much money out of it, but you want to get some money out of it. So here you have copyright custodians who have an interest in market. In fact, you could argue that it really should go above here because they have an interest in doing something to market these products. No one has a copyright interest in marketing these products. Amazon might have, but most of them are for sale for nothing. And yet, all that money is left on the table. And the story of this part of the economy is the story of driving transactions costs down. And it occurred to me, I don't know, just a month ago when I heard this expression, which I'd heard lots of times before, and I used it earlier, I think I did, technology stack. A technology stack is a whole bunch of technologies and software packages built on each other, and they operate with effectively zero transactions cost between them. Nobody's asking permission to use this or that. And when you can, and this is why, you know, Google works on Linux and open source software and stuff. It's really hard to sort of explain, but once you get those transactions cost down to negligible levels, incredible things happen, and you can see that there. And you can certainly see how transactions costs depress that. And here is the bar where Kookaburra sits on the old gum tree, sits. And one day somebody makes a little bit of money, and so why would they give it away?
So the copyright's run out.
Copyright has expired here and probably half expired there. And these are all fully in copyright, and they don't sell because it's too much trouble. You've got the publisher, you've got the author, you've got residual rights, everybody's got to work everything out. People have got to send checks for $3.43 to people in the post, and it just doesn't happen.
And this is the number of distinct
titles
on Amazon. By decade.
Yeah, right. Correct.
Questions about the US system of sort of flexible exceptions. The first one, I was wondering, there were four criteria there. Are they alternative criteria that you rely on?
And criteria. You're sort of weighing something, if you like. They're not expressed in points, but out of 100 points, you know, I'd say 40 points go to test 4, it's all done qualitatively rather than quantitatively, but you kind of get the feeling whether this is a fair use or not by going through those tests. Anyway, sorry.
Yeah, and so the final criterion you mentioned was about impact on the market for that product.
Yeah.
I was wondering how much that had been sort of tested, whether you know how much that's been tested in sort of court action and things like that. I mean, I suppose the thing I'm wondering is that, you know, music piracy advocates argue that often they help improve the market because you get music for free, you find out about more music than you would have listened to otherwise, and then you go out and buy some of it later.
That's right. So in principle, you would be able to argue that in a US court, and the US court would throw it out because it's clearly... it might be right and it might be wrong, but it's clearly a major act of competing with the person trying to sell the rights. And they're not going to say that's fair use, even if you can show that in the grand scheme of things it's actually good for them. Which there's no doubt in some cases it is, but you know, there's lots of cases where it isn't. So it's not... If you're in any kind of serious act of competing with the rights holder, it isn't fair use. And it's actually very important to realise that as well, because so much of the IP debate gets sort of sucked into the vortex of the piracy debate and to people's anxiety about the free rider problem. And this isn't about any of that. So the next question is, well, why do the rights holders really care? And part of the answer is the answer I gave to Peter, which is that they might pick up a windfall here and there, so why would they give it away? And another part of the answer is a kind of a defensive mindset, where I'm quite serious when I say this, and I will provide you with hard evidence of it. The rights lobby, the IP rights, the people who are defending IP rights will back stronger IP rights even where it does them no good at all, and it does some harm to someone else, and even where it does some of them some harm. The example is the example of an Australian company, both in 2004 and then again in 2008, wanted to export generic pharmaceuticals from Adelaide to countries around the world where the patent had expired. In Australia, we provided patent extensions, and the patent extension had not expired in Australia. The patent right extends not just to the right to sell into a market, but to the right to manufacture. So the manufacturer in Adelaide had no right to make this drug, even though they were intending to do no harm to the rights holder's right. In both cases, the relevant company approached the government, in one case the Howard government and then the Rudd government, saying, let's try and change this, let's make the necessary arrangements to change this. The pharmaceutical companies opposed this. One of the pharmaceutical companies was going to be a major beneficiary of the project because it was going to supply the project. And the pharmaceutical companies have a story that they want to tell countries, which is, if you give us more intellectual property protection, which we had because we've given them patent extensions, we will do more things in your country. The production went to India, which doesn't have patent extensions. Nobody gained from that. There were no winners from that. So why would you do that? And I think the answer is that if you're defending a legacy business model, you try and hang on to whatever rights you have. And that's unfortunately... And it works quite well because you can say... the way that story was covered by Alan Jones, for instance, and a number of media outlets, was that this was breaching the patent. It takes some time. It takes at least 30 seconds to actually understand what was happening. And so it's easy to draw that into the idea that there's piracy going on. But this has got nothing to do with that.
Well, we have no more questions. I'd just like to thank you all for coming and thank Dr. Ruin for his presentation. As I said earlier, we'll be endeavouring through the autumn sittings to bring a range more presentations on the issue of copyright reform in the context of the ALRC's inquiry. And if we could thank Dr. Gruen, please.
Thank you.
And I'd also like to thank Parliamentary Broadcasting for recording the session. Thank you.
Happy to discuss it in person down here if you want to discuss it.
Following good advice. That's right. Is the spike in 2000 just because it's new books, or is it there's also
New books? Yeah, it's just new graphic.
It's just new books.
Because Amazon wouldn't really include anything. Look, because there is a surge of people that are giving away copyright
books. These are decades.
But that's just new books, not because the other type of people are giving away them, rather than selling them, and here's a material I've created, I'll give it away. They're not doing that to Amazon.
Yeah, I guess they're not. But there are some interesting things going on Amazon. You've got Amazon singles. I don't know whether they let you give them away for free, because they take 30%. But Amazon singles may be free.
I've got an offer from Amazon coming to see me tomorrow, who are telling me that they're setting up their data center in Australia. I think a bunch of people got quite excited. A bunch of people were getting quite excited because I think they thought Amazon were going to have a retail retail center here, which would mean you get to pick up like that. It's an online
service.
Are the copyright holders kind of which in Australian alliance of libraries, education, research, Google, private sector, online is the challenge. But not ours, they're only a bit for the
Because of course,
that's a report to the ADA and the ADA submission and it's just such a no-brainer for economists to get themselves interested in this stuff. These issues are everywhere, and they're all no-brainers. There's nothing that's hard to make up your mind. They're questions like, should we retrospectively get copyright? Well, no. If there's an argument at all, it's only an argument for a prospective extension. And so all the rights that are at issue, you just eyeball them and you go, that's crazy. And yet economists are obviously, get articles about talking about things they believe right in or copyright. I can tell you what, it's no linear opposite. It's, none of the interesting intellectual questions are under wraps. It's all the basic bricks and mortar making something more sensible. It's like coming into the local content plan of cars and saying, are you guys mad? Is this crazy? So the departments that are in charge of this, which is AGs,
domestically, and also the one which showed how simple it used to be when you get a creator, a publisher, a printer, a distributor, and customers,
And does that make sense of what would be in Australia?
That's when you're accustomed to the region.
Or not?
Yeah, because it could become large for you. You put it in a
The US Government Treasury, so yeah.
Uh-huh. So this is part of the usual process.
Yes.
Yeah.
Nicholas,
okay, see you there.
Yeah.
See you. Okay.
Yeah.
David. Oh, yeah. David Drew.
Yeah.
Sorry.
Okay, good. Yeah.
Okay.
See you later.
See you.
The fascinating, in the US all the IT companies, particularly, and pharmaceutical companies are just patenting every little bit.
Yeah.
And then you could be saying, I'm going to build something that's not even closely related to what you've done over here, and that's a very long bow to say it's in the same market because it's something quite difficult.
Yes.
To say, oh, you've used this tiny little thing, where the tiniest little idea,
Well,
this tiny part of what we did, you've ripped off, and so we're going to see you. And
Benson and Levine did a study, and I don't know how the methodology was done, I don't know how you would do this, but they did a study in which they looked at the legal costs of patenting, again, the private costs of patenting against the private benefits, not the public benefits.
Yes.
The private benefits are greater than the public benefits. You can make a lot of money out of the patent than the people are suffering because you're charging a higher price. And they found that the private costs of holding patents exceed the private benefits of holding patents in every industry in the United States except chemicals, which is a bit above the line, and pharmaceuticals, which is still well above the line. Everything else, it would be better if there were no patents at all. But of course, if you have a product, you need to patent it because somebody else might patent your product.
Yeah.
And you can see this in smartphones. It's really terrible what's going on. So,
yeah.
So legal costs of patenting in the United States are $29 billion a year of patenting and defending patents and so on. And that's 10% of the R&D budget of the country.
That's made Apple look like a very progressive company, look very poor.
Well, because they do all the same thing. And you expect them to do the same things. And I'm not moralistic about it. If I was them, I'd probably do the same thing. Google is a kind of a standout because it seems to think that it shouldn't be evil. And it still has defensively had to buy Motorola. So had to spend $12 billion that it didn't want to spend to get hold of 200 patents to defend it against all these trolls. But it can defend itself against Apple, but it can't defend itself against Nathan Myhrvold's, who's a billionaire from Microsoft, who's got this company called Intellectual Ventures, which is a patent troll. Because if they have a patent on Android, you've got to pay them, because Google can't screw them over with their patent portfolio. It's dreadful. It's really serious.
Yeah.
And the only country in the world that I know of whose bureaucracy advised their government, you're a small country, it is in your interest not to promote stronger intellectual property, is the NED New Zealand.
Oh, really?
And so they're the only
country in the TPP. It's quite, we do quite a good tag team inadvertently, because we do it. Craig Edison's been quite good on state investment sanctions, and New Zealand's quite good on IP sanctions. And then we put pressure, and then the Americans lean on New Zealanders to put pressure on us about the state investment provision, and we and lean on us to put pressure on the New Zealanders on IP extension. We all happily go along with this mad state of affairs when we should be forming our own Cairns group around London.
So let's organise for you to come up and give a seminar. That'd be good. Okay.
Okay, see you next time.
Okay. See you later.
Take care.
Thank you. Bye.